Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Kat Banyard. Kat Banyard is the author of The Equality Illusion and is a founder and director of UK Feminista, an organisation supporting grassroots feminist activism. She is also the founder of Femme Conferences. Kat was previously campaigns officer at the Fawcett Society, the UK's leading campaign for women's rights, and she was a regular spokesperson for the organisation in national print and broadcast media. In 2007, she was profiled in Observer Woman magazine as one of the new feminists. Prior to her work at Fawcett, Kat worked for the Northern Refugee Centre in Sheffield, setting up women's groups. So I'm talking to Kat Banyard, and we're going to be talking about her book, The Equality Illusion, The Truth About Women and Men Today. So Kat, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Thanks for inviting me.
I want to talk about what influenced you to write the book, really. And at the start of the book, you talk about there's sort of quite a common idea around within, I suppose, young women now, but women in general, that feminism has achieved its aims and is, in some ways, to their lives, irrelevant and some sort of an anachronism. Have you found that this is really such a common perception?
I think it is, and also I'd say among men as well. We're told day in, day out that we live in a post-feminist age, and I know for me personally, when I was growing up, I assumed it was just that inequality between women and men was a thing of the past, something that you read about in the history books. It was something that had black and white photos usually associated with it. It wasn't something relevant to the world today, now. And for me personally, it was the process of going to university, having gone to an all-girls state school, and just experiencing casual sexism on a day-to-day basis that really started to open my eyes. And as I started to read some more about sort of feminism and feminist issues, I suddenly became gripped by this sense of injustice, one about the fact that there are quite clearly still massive inequalities between women and men, but two, the fact that it didn't feel like anybody was talking about it, that it wasn't headline news. And yet, if we look around today, 100,000 women are raped every single year in the UK alone. Women are still being paid around 20% less than men at work, and just 22% of our MPs are female. Now, that's not what a post-feminist society looks like. So it was really that sense that we have a massive problem that goes right to the very heart of our society, but which we just take as given, as a natural part of our cultural and political landscape. It really drove me to want to write this book.
Let's have a look at some of the... You go through the book looking at some of the more common barriers to an equal society. Some of these things are old things that have continued. Some of these things are newer, or at least massively overemphasised into the modern society, should I say. The first one I want to look at is the idea of the body image, which, again, is something that's always been there, but suddenly, again, seems to be really intense at the moment.
Yeah, well, the pressures on women and girls to mould and modify and manipulate their appearances have never been greater than they are today. And the tools on hand to enable them to do that have never been more extreme. So now when we talk about beauty culture today, we can use words such as slicing and pulling and cutting of the skin and of the flesh to describe what are actually now quite common beauty practices.
So you're talking obviously here about the massive rise in plastic surgery.
That's right. And it's overwhelmingly women who are the consumers of it. So what we've seen is just a complete normalisation of cosmetic surgery. So that's happened through the rise of cosmetic surgery, reality TV shows, through marketing, through the press. And so today it just seems pretty normal. When you go up escalators, you know, in London Underground stations, it's quite normal to see posters advertising the local cosmetic surgeon's clinic. Somehow as a society we've just accepted it as yet another means through which women are expected to modify their appearance. Now the problem is that it's not only that women and girls are being told that their appearance matters, that they're judged on that on a daily basis, it's also that women and girls learn from a very young age to start seeing themselves as objects. So they see their own bodies through effectively the eyes of others. And what we know is that this has very significant implications for young girls' sense of self, their self-esteem. And all of this is, of course, linked into massive rates of eating disorders that we see.
Eating disorders is something that, it's a really new phenomenon, isn't it? I mean, they were almost unheard of 40 years ago even.
That's right. And actually a really fascinating study showed how quickly eating disorders can come about. So a team of academics studied the effect that introducing mainstream Western TV had on a community in Fiji. And they found that when they went in there was basically a zero rate of eating disorders amongst young girls. Now, 3 months after the introduction of Western TV, they measured rates again, and they found that the rate was over 11%. And we've also seen rates of anorexia in Western society really explode since the mainstreaming of beauty ideals has got more prolific amongst mainstream media.
So I'm going to move on to another one of the aspects of what has now become mainstream media that has re-emphasised, you know, this adherence to some sort of ideal and sort of plastic surgery is involved in that, and that's obviously pornography. But before we get to that point, I want to have a look at domestic violence. So you've already mentioned that it's estimated that 100,000 women a year are raped in the UK. You talk in the book about the prevalence of certain rape myths, which sort of helped to cloud on the very, very few occasions. It's something like 6% of rapes actually get to court. Mm. On the very few occasions that happens, that often the members of the court and the jury are influenced by rape myths that are sort of prevalent in society. So perhaps we could talk about what sort of things those actually are.
Well, the view that women are somehow to blame for their rape, that they're somehow culpable, is really at the heart of rape myths. What rape myths do is excuse the perpetrator and either deny or minimise the crime. And these myths about rape are drip-fed through mainstream media and through all parts, I'd say, of mainstream culture. And so one of the most prevalent is that if a woman has drunk alcohol, that she is somehow to blame, that she has put herself at risk. But fundamentally, what this really does is show that we are failing to actually acknowledge that there is such a thing as rapists. Rape is a choice. It is a decision by someone to try and enact control and violence over a woman. So the fact that she has had a drink is, for all intents and purposes, irrelevant to deciding whether or not that crime has taken place. Unless you think that women drinking alcohol is wrong and somehow rape is in any way, shape or form a justified punishment for that. And I don't think that there are as many people who would align themselves to that view. But what we really need to do is place the perpetrator in the picture. Why is it that men are choosing to rape women, and why is it that they are targeting women who they perceive as being more vulnerable or less likely to be believed if they speak out.
That theme is sort of very prevalent in a lot of rape prevention advertising, for instance. I mean, the one that immediately springs to mind is the one about the unlicensed minicabs that you'll see on the tubes these days. And it's, at best, it's sort of saying that, you know, women should be responsible for their own safety and that the men have no agency. At worst, it's almost throwing their hands up and saying, well, there's absolutely nothing we can do about this, so you're just going to have to look after yourselves. It just seems like incredibly pessimistic at best.
That's right. I mean, safety precautions, of course, are important. We all have to take, you know, precautions in our daily lives. But I would say, where are the posters telling men not to rape?
Indeed.
We've got so many posters telling women not to get raped. They're not going to get to the heart of this. We need to be targeting men and boys and challenging the attitudes and the cultures which, in particular circumstances, make some men think it is okay or even desirable for them to rape a woman. And, you know, as a society, I think we completely block out of view the perpetrator, and we've got to bring them back into the picture. Rape is not inevitable. It is a choice, in which case we need to start shaping and changing those choices.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Kat Banyard about her book, The Equality Illusion, The Truth About Women and Men Today. So in the first half, Kat, we sort of vaguely alluded to the fact that pornography is becoming sort of normalised in society, and that's just one of a number of subjects that you talk about next in the book, under the rubric of the sex industry. And one almost can't help but look in awe at the sex industry for this incredible con trick it's basically pulled on society. In there is this presentation now of pornography, lap dancing clubs, and even prostitution as being a sort of liberating choice for women and a way for women to take control of their sexuality and liberate it. I mean, how did this happen?
Good question. I mean, you're absolutely right. The sex industry today is presented and held up almost as being the promised land of feminism. Everything that activists and campaigners have been working for over the past 100 years, sexual liberation, empowerment, choice. But in fact, if you actually look at the reality of the women's lives who are working in the sex industry, the impact that it has on society as a whole, it's quite clear that it's the opposite of what feminism has been working for. Is in fact, I think, one of the biggest attacks on or the gains of feminism. It represents a massive backlash against gains in women's rights. So over the last 2 to 3 decades, there has been a massive growth and expansion of the sex industry, and that's been enabled through economic policies, you know, the proclaimed sexual revolution of the 1960s and 70s. And also by a very adept marketing campaign, essentially, by the sex industry, which has held itself up as representing women's rights. It's co-opted the language of feminism. So lap dancing is an empowering choice. Prostitution is just ordinary work. And it's been very, very successful in silencing the critics. So anyone who has dared to speak out against pornography and prostitution has been quickly labelled a prude or anti-sex. And it's only been in the past few years that dissenting voices have started to be heard. And what's been really heartening for me, I think, is just how quickly that's been gathering momentum. And in fact, the sex industry has been a major catalyst in the resurgence of feminism that we're seeing at the moment. It's bringing people back onto the streets, essentially, because now sexism is being thrust in people's faces. You can't go to the local corner shop to buy, you know, a bottle of milk without being unwittingly exposed to pornography. There's no getting away from it now. Whilst at the same time, it's a massive problem, it is also bringing about its own demise.
You've obviously done the research and you've spoken to lots of people that are working in the sex industry. And let's talk about some of those experiences. When you've spoken to women working in prostitution, let's talk about how they describe their day-to-day life. I mean, the reality is, it's an obvious thing to say, but the reality is clearly not the, you know, the Billy Piper Secret Diary of a Call Girl image that's sort of presented on the TV, is it?
No, of course it's not. I mean, I would say every single woman's experience in the sex industry is different. And we can't talk about women in the sex industry as if they are a homogenous group. But what we do know through, what I know through speaking to individual women who are involved in it and through the extensive research that's been done on it, is that many women share all too harrowing commonalities, one of which is the, you know, the experience of trauma. 68% of women in prostitution have post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, that's a rate comparable with survivors of state-sponsored torture and rape. And in fact, 9 out of 10 women in prostitution say that they want to get out, but they don't feel that they're able to. The reality is that women's routes into prostitution are littered with exclusion and abuse and marginalisation. You know, in this country, up to 75% of people who are in prostitution started prostituting before they were 18 years old. I mean, does that sound like something representing an empowered choice? Of course it doesn't. We also know that people who are in prostitution have experienced sexual abuse as children at much higher rates than the general population. And in effect, that makes sense because a common consequence of sexual abuse is later being sexually victimised, having difficulties asserting boundaries. So we know that prostitution is a consequence, more often than not, of abuse and marginalisation. And then when women get into prostitution, the actual act of having to have repeated and often violent sex with multiple men that they don't know on a daily basis is inherently traumatising.
This is going to be an impossible question to answer, really, because it's quite utopian. But given a sort of, you know, a possible future society of equality, would we then be in the position where choosing to work in, for women to work in the sex industry would be a valid, liberating choice? Or do you think that because of the context in which women get into prostitution in the first place and the fact that we're now living in an equal society, the demand would just not be there any longer?
I think in a truly equal society where being a man didn't mean rejecting women, controlling women, there wouldn't be demand for prostitution because there wouldn't be men who would be willing and wanting to treat women as dehumanised sex objects. There wouldn't be men who found that sexually appealing. And as you say, all of the risk factors and all of the experiences of abuse and exclusion that drive women into the industry would not be there. But I think, you know, we can talk about utopian views. What we're dealing right now is the hard reality that there are women, lots of women, who are at risk of going into the sex industry. What we can do right now, and we don't have to wait for a utopian equal society, is to start challenging demand and challenging men who think it's okay to treat women like sex objects and to buy women's bodies in this way through prostitution, through pornography, through lap dancing clubs. Most men don't do it. Most men reject it. But too few men speak out against it and challenge their peers. What's been really exciting for me, I think, over recent weeks and months is new projects which are starting to gather men together who are opposed to the exploitation of women to start taking action. One of those is something called the Men Against Porn Project. And that's about men starting to challenge themselves and challenge each other about using pornography. Because the really sad truth is that at the moment, boys are raised on a diet of sexually exploiting women. You'd be hard-pressed to find a young boy who hasn't watched pornography. And in fact, if he was to admit to his peers that he didn't like it or didn't want to use it, he would quite likely face ridicule. So that is where we need to start, to say to boys that it's not okay, it's not normal, in fact, it's not acceptable to be treating women like sexual objects.
The reason I sort of raised the idea of the sort of utopian equal society is to tease out this idea that what's currently happening now is we're sort of, by presenting the sex industry in a way of sort of liberating women's sexuality, it's ignoring the fact that, A, men are treating women as sex objects, but also that, well, there's a fantastic quote. You quote the owner of a lap dancing club saying that, we're providing a service and basically the NHS should be paying for it or something. And there's an idea that there's this whole sort of coterie of men out there that are lonely and it's perfectly reasonable for them to go out and sort of pay for sex, completely scotches over the fact that there is another person in this equation, which is the woman that is being used.
Quite. I mean, it's tapping into really old ideals of, you know, men having a sex right, a right to access women's bodies, which is everything that feminism is about reacting against. And there are so many excuses put forward for sexually exploiting women, but by far and away the most successful has been that it's about providing a service, that it's ordinary work. So it's just another part of the market that, as you characterise, the women are sort of pushed into the shadows. And so you've got, you know, industry bodies like the International Union of Sex Workers, whose membership includes pimps and pornographers and punters, lobbying very hard for the whole industry to be decriminalised and using all sorts of rhetoric around the fact that this would somehow make prostitution safe. And what we know is that it will do no such thing, and that the only approaches that really work are around tackling the demand for prostitution and supporting the women who are in it to get out and to get support services. Because, as the women themselves report, the overwhelming majority are quite adamant that they want to get out of it.
To finish off then, there's a quote towards the back of the book where you say, "What is abundantly clear is that ending discrimination against women will require no less than a total transformation of society at every level." And clearly that's, as an overall project, is possibly a bit ambitious. Let's talk about some of the things that actually are happening, and you've mentioned a couple of times that there's been a rise in feminist activism recently, and obviously the internet has had a lot to do with this. So let's tell us about some of the started off with UK Feminista, of course, which is your own group. Let's talk about some of the burgeoning movements.
Okay, we set up UK Feminista to coincide with the launch of the Equality Illusion, because what I fundamentally didn't want is for people to read about these issues and then put the book back on the shelf, and that was it, and carry on their day-to-day lives, essentially. And to be honest, I don't think once you read about the issues, when you really fully appreciate the scale of the problems that we have, that you can just carry on as you were before. But it's all very well saying action, change needs to happen, people need to do something. But in fact, actually putting that into practice can be quite difficult. So we set up UK Feminista to support individuals, women and men, to start taking action in their daily lives in support of campaign acts and various campaigns that are going on. And what the organisation has done is to profile the fantastic feminist activism that's been burgeoning across the country over, you know, the past few years and escalating in recent months. And today there are now over 60 local feminist groups that have just been started by women and men, you know, in their spare time, in between their studies, after work, people who are not willing just to let it all go on as it is. And if I think back when I first started getting involved in feminism in about 2003, you know, I could probably count the number of local feminist groups on one hand. So it's incredibly exciting to see all that happen. And we've had, you know, a proliferation of feminist blogs and websites, conferences, meetings. And for me, just in terms of seeing this activity take place, it's really important because it started to shift the terms of public debate. Until last year, if feminism was lucky enough to get, you know, covered in mainstream British press, if it was even to get a headline, it would usually include the word death and lack of. But this year, because feminism is becoming more visible in communities, in universities, it hasn't gone unnoticed in the media. And so we've started changing the terms of debates We're getting headlines which are noticing the resurgence in feminism. But also, we started to see tangible gains and tangible wins from this activism. So this year, two new laws came into force, which were the direct result of mass campaigning at a local level. And one was the way that lap dancing clubs were licensed. Previously, they were licensed like restaurants and karaoke bars, so it was basically very easy to set them up and very hard to object to them. Now they're licensed like sex shops and sex cinemas, meaning it's a lot easier to control their spread and to stop them opening. In fact, in my borough of Hackney, the council is now consulting to set a nil policy on lap dancing clubs, which would basically mean there would be zero tolerance of sexual exploitation through lap dancing clubs, which is huge and incredibly exciting. And I would encourage anyone who is listening and lives in Hackney to voice their support, write to the council, say that you support this, because it's such a huge step forward. We've also seen another change in the law this year, which is a change in prostitution law, which for the first time started to shift the gaze of the eyes of the law off from women and onto the men who are perpetrating the exploitation. So now it's a criminal offence to pay for sex acts with a person who has been forced. Now, it's just a small step forward. That's just one small part, but it's really significant, I think. And both of these two changes were the result of local people, local activists, writing to their MPs, writing to their local newspapers. And it really showed what can happen when feminists get mobilised. The trick now, while we have seen this growth in interest in feminism, is really to start ensure that we sustain it and capitalise on it, which is one of the reasons we set up UK Feminista, because fundamentally, for long-standing campaigning, which is utterly crucial to social change, you need the boring old stuff of infrastructure. You need the organisations that are there that can provide the resources, the tools, the briefings and so on. So that's why we set up the organisation. Our task now is really to get the funding in and make feminist activism sustainable.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. I've been talking to Kat Banyard about the equality illusion, the truth about women and men today. Kat, thanks for speaking to us today.
Thanks ever so much, Neil.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.